You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling.
All right, welcome back. We are on section 111. Of Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger. Reading the book all the way through, word for word. And I haven't said this in a while, so just a reminder, when we say bang, we are pronouncing B-E-Y-N-G, which is a respelling of being that Heidegger uses to describe a more eventful, I don't know, some different kind of being.
Right? Yeah. A better kind of being.
I don't know if you would buy that. All right. The book, in a sense, is an attempt to understand what we have yet to understand, which is what is meant by bang. So, you ready to go?
Yeah.
Go.
111, the a priori and nature, i.e., what is first by nature. Nature, the paradigm, and the earlier than descent origin. The earliest, the first to come to presence, the presencing is nature itself, though in unity with truth, immediately covered over by the form. How does such a question of the first arise? On the basis of the form as the highest being. The earliest in the essential occurrence is the essential occurrence itself as that of bang. A priori, from what goes before, the a priori only where the guiding question. Metaphysics. In the transition, however, only apparently is the a priori still a problem. Conceived in terms of the event, the relation between bang and beings is quite different.
Yeah. Anything to say?
It's a little over my head.
Yeah, it's over mine too. I mean, kind of. I mean,
there were some Greek words in there that we translated.
Yeah. So it feels a little sort of like little notey diary entries, really. It's just sort of like jotting down ideas.
Yeah.
Little perspectival jingles in a way. But he's starting by kind of pointing out that we have this concept of nature, and nature is given a kind of status as the precedent, the paradigm, the earlier than, the origin, that from which all descends. So, first up, the first to come to presence. Nature is presencing itself in unity with truth. So there's truth in nature, but it's all it's all covered up by the form. So he wants to begin by pointing out that our cognitive inclination is to establish this kind of idea of nature or precedence or the first. The origin, the paradigm that is before us, that seems to be a conceptual instinct. How does such a question of the, is that word first?
Yeah.
On the basis of the, yeah, so Well, we have this basis that is posited by us, this basis called nature, and then it's immediately covered over by the form. So the form comes and blankets or coats or deletes or negates the immediate presencing of nature. And then he says something interesting. He says, how do we even get to the question of what's first? Mm-hmm. As if there's, as if that's even possible, as if that's a good question, as if it's even a thing that we can ascertain. He says the answer to that question is on the basis of the form as the highest being. Mm. So he kind of points out that the heritage of the idea of the form, or even the idea of the form as established in Plato's time, is in a way why we have this question of what is first. Might be a little hard to conceive of, but in a sense, the question of what is first doesn't have to be a question. It's not a necessary question. It's not... there's no reason it has any truck in logical rigor. We could have a different idea. We could say there is no first. We could say there's only recurrence, or that sequences are artificial, or that the search for a first is a dead end. But we've come to this idea of nature and this firstness because we also have this idea of the form as the highest being. And why the form as the highest being leads to the question of the first is a little bit of a mystery. But I think we'll probably keep reading and maybe we'll come to find out the earth. But then he says a little bit, he explains a little bit, the earliest in the essential occurrence is the essential occurrence itself as that of bang. So, essential occurrence, right, leads us to this idea of form, and the earliest form or the earliest essential occurrence is the essential occurrence itself as that of bang. So, bang is kind of brought in as the earliest essential occurrence in this form-led conception of nature and firstness. Bang, I think here would probably be juxtaposed to form and be something that is contained in or synonymous with nature, but that has been covered over by form. He then goes to the idea of a priori, which again is a priori is anything that is derived from logic or abstract principles and exists prior to experience. A priori, from what goes before. Again, there it is. The a priori only were the guiding question, metaphysics. Not quite sure what that means. I mean, essentially, the a priori is only a question. The a priori is only relevant to metaphysics and the guiding question, which I guess is what is being.
Yeah.
In the transition, however, so the transition to the other beginning, only apparently is the a priori still a problem. Conceived in terms of the event, the relation between bang and beings is quite different. So a priori seems here to have something to do with the relationship between bang and beings. I mean, bang, I would say, is separate from the a priori. A priori is the world of forms, and in a sense, therefore, the world of beings. As being, as posited representational being. So the a priori is a problem, is not really a problem in the transition to the other beginning, because the transition to the beginning is a return to the event, a return to bang, and a reappraising of the relationship between bang and beings. And in that transition, in that other beginning, we might even find that the a priori is not only not a problem, but is not what we thought it was, and maybe doesn't even exist. So, I mean, I guess that's a mysterious parsing of a mysterious passage, but it's...
That was nicely done.
Yeah, thanks. All right, shall we go on?
Yeah, sure.
Something you want to say about all that? I mean, yeah.
Not particularly.
I think my last statement would be, I think just in a very simple level, we were talking about this yesterday, I think nature and form. I think he's setting up binaries here, distinctions between nature and form, between bang and the a priori, between the drive to establish what is first and the question of that drive. And so it's kind of a part of Heidegger's attempt to really get us to deconstruct and look anew at how our conceptual categories have been established, why we feel driven to persist in them, why they were established in the first place, what questions they were trying to answer. Everyone kind of takes nature and origin and the paradigm and the presencing of the first or the earliest as a given, but it's not a given. It's a conceptual form that may actually be masking something else, that may be standing in the way of a relationship with bang, and may indeed need to be overturned as we make a transition to the other beginning. Last, I just think it's really exciting to think what might thought be in the absence of the idea that there is such a thing as nature. Or an original, or a first, or a line of descent, or a paradigm of experience, or something that is always present. And that's the thing about nature. Nature is not sort of here and then not here and then comes back, and then it's just omnipresent. It's always there. And why did we feel the need to create that concept and have a relationship concept? How has that concept come to be not only domineering, but perhaps concealing? Yeah.
Do you have a response to that?
Yeah. What? Can you make a response?
No. I mean, how is nature being ever present domineering?
Well, the idea that there's the idea that you can have a word for something like nature calls in a question what we're doing with words and what the abandonment by being really is, because nature is obviously a category word. It's obviously, in a sense, the height of an identitarian proposition that there is such a thing as nature. And I don't think we know, you know, they even talk about this in Enviro books, what is nature and what is not nature. And I think Heidegger's actually using nature like more generally, that it's just kind of like substance or, but you know, for instance, how sound is it to say that the nature that was present in Plato's time is the nature that is still present? Because mm-hmm. Again, we're not talking about lakes and fish and trees here. We're talking about the original substance of existence, right? It's the mm-hmm. word for that. And does it mean anything? You know, does it really mean anything? And if it doesn't mean anything, why are we using it? And if it doesn't mean anything, how does having something that doesn't mean anything be so omnipresent in our conceptualization of the world get in our way, mm-hmm. perhaps? Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about human nature. I mean, talk about an interesting misnomer or an interesting mistake. I mean, is there a human nature? Is that just the sum of everything humans do? Mm-hmm. I think we mean more than that, but I'm not sure we mean anything, and I'm not sure it's a good idea to even try to mean something like along those lines, mm-hmm. that there is a human nature. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's a totally different way of thinking. I also really like this idea of questioning what is first, or our desire to establish what is first.
Yes.
It's also really...
Yeah.
Yeah,
go ahead.
It just makes me think of like trying to find the... I guess like the magic bullet, the answer,
yeah.
the origin.
The cause, yeah.
The cause.
Yeah.
Which is like...
Yeah.
I feel like... Yeah, I don't know, like in a way easy to label, but not necessarily having a relationship with truth.
Yeah, and I think that's a good clue into what this paragraph means. How does such a question of the first arise on the basis of the form as the highest being? Mm-hmm. Because you, as you just pointed out, when you go seeking the first in what you assume is a homogenous strain of nature over time and place, and this that just sort of this idea of an omnipresent substance in which everything is embedded and can logically move freely about, as you go looking for the first, what you're really trying to do is you're trying to connect that first to something else, right? Mm-hmm. To a subsequent, to an origin story, mm-hmm. To a manifestation, to the unfolding of a paradigm, to maybe the solution to a problem, mm-hmm. to a deeper understanding of some conceptual mystery, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, that's all kind of only possible because we have this idea of the idea or the form, mm-hmm. which again is really just identity, and it's only all possible because identity is always trans-identity, not trans-identity gender-wise, but identity is always identity over time and place. And it's mm-hmm. it forms a kind of conceptual medium in which ideas can travel around mm-hmm. without ever having to touch grass. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest kind of, traffickings about in the a priori sphere is that search for the first, for the cause, for the paradigm, for the net, for the nature of things. And, you know, and the nature, mm-hmm. and again, it's like, okay, you have a problem, right? You have like intrusive thoughts, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to find out, I think that conceptually Heidegger would say that what you're doing is you're trying to figure them out is you're trying to understand their nature. Mm-hmm. What is the nature of intrusive thoughts? And mm-hmm. and in a way, Heidegger's just calling us to say, well, what do you mean by nature? Mm-hmm. The nature of something. Mm-hmm. Well, what you mean is the essence of it, the form of it, the idea of it. And yet, in pursuing that nature, form, essence, and idea, are you really talking about it? Mm-hmm. Or are you just formalizing it and sending yourself off on a priori goose chases? Mm-hmm. Goose chases, what is it? Mm-hmm. Blame duck chase, what's the phrase?
Yeah.
Blind goose chase? I can't remember.
But physis, the word for nature, also means the self-emergent, which is...
Well, the self-emergent, that's right. I mean, in other words, like that
which... making it, appear to the self.
I don't know if that's what self-emergent means. Okay. I would say that self... Is that a definition out of the back of the book or something?
Yeah. I mean,
physis as the self-emergent means that, I would say that, you know, in a Greek thinking, is it's that which puts itself forward. Mm. Like that there's an animacy, Hegel would say something like there's like a negative positing, a positing through negation, the creation of identity with indifference, that the self-emergent is like nature just happens. Mm-hmm. Nature just comes to be, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's what is meant by self-emergent. Mm-hmm. The self-showing, the self-appearing, mm-hmm. that which gives itself to be known. Maybe?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I guess the word nature, physis, is just a little confusing. Because I feel like in the past we've treated it as like actually nature. And then now we're looking at it, I think you said very nicely, this category of something that is made present as an idea. So I guess I'm a little unsure what it means.
Physis?
Yeah.
Well, physis is a Greek word that most commonly translates to nature, mm-hmm. and refers to the principle of growth and change. Mm-hmm. It is often contrasted with nomos, which means law or custom. And it can also refer to the natural growth or change within a thing. Mm-hmm. So it's, what do we want to say? It's animacy. Mm-hmm. That's almost how I would mm-hmm. translate physis. Mm-hmm. Animacy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here it is. Physis and techne.
Right.
Let me read the Wikipedia introduction here. Physis is a Greek philosophical term used translation into nature. The term originated in ancient Greek philosophy. Was later. Physis was contrasted with nomos, law, human convention. So the natural world, the human law, the human mm-hmm. world, right? The world of events, the world of laws. Another opposition, particularly well known from the works of Aristotle, is that of physis and techne. In this case, what is produced and what is artificial are distinguished from beings that arise spontaneously from their own essence. Mm-hmm. So that's the self-emergent, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Techne is... how should we say, right? Like a car mm-hmm. is techne. Cars mm-hmm. don't grow out of the ground. Mm-hmm. But beets and coyotes grow out of the ground. They are self-emergent, right? Mm-hmm. So that's physis. That's animacy. Mm-hmm. Cars are not animate. Things that we make, techne, they are not animate. They have been propelled into existence by our efforts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why did I get off on that train?
I mean, I brought it up, but
you brought what up? What did you say again?
I was just saying that I was trying to understand.
A little confused about the definition of the term.
Yeah. I guess, and then this phrase, "What is first by nature," is a whole nother nature, the paradigm, and the earlier than descent or origin. Because then he's combining that idea of first and nature together, which is... Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Not fitting into my clean categories in my mind.
Yeah.
But that's also okay. We can keep going.
Yeah, let's keep going and see what he says, because he talks a lot more about the a priori. And,
112, the a priori. The a priori in the proper sense, only where form, which means that beingness as the
highest being.
Highest being is more eminently and thereby is in the first place a being. The a priori, in accord with the way Plato introduced it, will in the future always mean for metaphysics that beingness comes before beings. In company with the form, the a priori becomes the perceptio, i.e. the a priori is assigned to the ego percipio and thus to the subject. In other words, representing is now what comes before. The understanding of being, as determined in being and time, appeared to be merely an extension of this representing that comes before, and yet, understanding as projection, Dasein, it is completely different as transition. However, it does point back into metaphysics. The truth of being and the essential occurrence of being are neither what comes earlier nor what comes later. Dasein is the simultaneity of time-space with what is true as a being, and it essentially occurs in the grounding ground.
As the grounding ground.
As the grounding ground, as the between and middle of beings themselves.
Yeah, so I think there's a little play going on with first and a priori and or priorness. And, you know, I mean, the idea of a priori is things that are known before you even have experience, that they're before the need to check empirical evidence. So they, in a sense, and they were given this name a priori. That's Latin, so it probably comes from the Middle Ages, and it's the idea that they are before experience. They are first in line. They precede experience. And I think one of the things he's just trying to do here is say this idea of logical laws and abstract principles and forms being first, as the phrase a priori seems to suggest, is questionable. Right? And of course, this is a common refrain in philosophical studies, right? Like the idea that, can you really have a priori principles that don't depend on experience at all? Because if you don't have experience, what exactly is a principle, right? Because principles are supposed to apply to experience. And of course, nobody has no experience. So the idea that you've got these ideas or principles or laws that are separate from experience is silly, because of course everything is an experience and comes out of experience. And so, but there's been given a priority, and it's right in that word, a priori. A priority has been given to these forms and these principles and these laws and these ideas that I think he's saying is questionable.
Can I say something? I just feel like, is that okay? Are you on a roll?
No, I'm not on a roll. Okay. Please speak.
Just to say, I think that's interesting.
Definitely not on a roll.
Because it makes, that to me clarifies the idea of like the first, because if you're thinking that like there is something that came up before first, like if it was a, let's say a phrase or an, I guess a supposed instinct or a thought, then the, you know, it might be seemingly, pose itself as a first or a habit or a reaction. But is that, like you said, is that a first or is that actually something that's been built up over time and just came as a first in this moment, but actually is not at all a first?
That's right. Yeah, and I mean, looking at, say, intrusive thoughts, or the the human penchant to understand oneself, right? Human drive to do that. Say, you know, you have intrusive thoughts and you want to kind of ask yourself what's going on there. Well, the pattern of thought is to sort of look for the a priori, look for rules, laws, tendencies, logical statements, propositions, ideas that can be said about intrusive thoughts in general, or the form of intrusive thoughts, as you might say, or the idea of them. It's and so you begin investigating and amassing all of these kind of general principles about intrusive thoughts as if those things apply to your intrusive thoughts. But that's really a bit of an ungrounded assumption, right? And more importantly, that is a investigatory habitus that may be a dead end or a wild goose chase. That's what it was. That's the phrase, right? A wild duck hunt. I don't know. I'm probably going to wonder that whole time. But so,
it's
you know,
too many children's books you're reading.
Yeah. So that search for the first is really the search for the a priori, a search for the prior, a search for the priority, a search for the higher idea, the highest being of the thing that you're looking into. Is all a in Heidegger's what Heidegger's proposing is perhaps is a false endeavor, and it's definitely a flight from bang, because it's a flight into being or beingness, the beingness of intrusive thoughts. And the idea of applying general ideas to them rather than looking at each one, say, specifically, understanding it itself without thinking that there are ideas that are precedent or formative or paradigmatic of that thing. That would be kind of like the bangy way of approaching intrusive thoughts or anything, any conceptual undertaking. So should I dive into the text?
Yeah. As a response to that, I'm going to jump ahead to that last paragraph where I feel like, in a way, what's being proposed is instead of looking for the first, kind of looking at the between or the middle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is a really,
That last paragraph is a really great, conclusion to this section. It's an exciting thing. So should we try to get there?
Yeah.
The a priori in the proper sense only where idea, so that makes sense, only where there is form is there a priori, which means that beingness as the highest being is more eminently and thereby is in the first place a being. So in a sense, beingness becomes a being that we relate to. And that's a very important idea, right? So, in a take the intrusive thoughts, intrusive thought idea. You have specific intrusive thoughts, but the beingness or the essence of intrusive thought becomes a being, and you start interacting with that rather than particular intrusive thoughts. The a priori, in accord with the way Plato introduced it, will in the future always mean for metaphysics that beingness comes before beings, right? That there's a that every being is a follow up to a beingness that existed before it, and that it's a manifestation of an idea or a form. In company with the form, the a priori becomes the perceptio. The a priori is assigned to the ego percipio and thus to the subject. In other words, representing is now what comes before. So conceptualizing, perceiving the form is what perception becomes, and representing becomes the paradigmatic task that occurs before any being is allowed to be. And the ego percipio, the perceiving self, and the subject are now not only a prioris, but they seek the a priori, they relate with the a priori, they posit the a priori as precedent, as in a sense a kin. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. The understanding of being as determined in being and time appeared to be merely an extension of this representing that comes before. So he's referring to his own book here, Understanding as Projection, Dasein. And yet, it is completely different. So my understanding of being is completely different from this representing that comes before, from this a priori. As transition, however, it does point back into metaphysics. So again, he's talking about the transition that is his thinking into the other beginning, and it points back to metaphysics because it is about a reformulation of the metaphysics. The truth of Bang and the essential occurrence of Bang are neither what comes earlier nor what comes later. Hmm. That's the super important sentence.
Yeah.
So as we seek Bang and the truth of Bang and the essential occurrence of Bang, we are not seeking points in a series. We're not seeking events in a sequence. So we're not doing that thing where we're going back and looking for a first that will not only clarify the present, but will determine the next, right? We're not doing this kind of sequentializing of our logical identities. Mm-hmm. Bang just is, and it does not come before or after anything else. So, of course, it does, but what he's saying is if we're making this transition to the other beginning and we're leaving behind the representing that comes before, then we are kind of rejecting that chronologization of events and experiences that has come to be known as what we might term analysis. Mm-hmm. Dasein is the simultaneity of time-space, is the simultaneity of time-space with what is true as a being. Dasein is the simultaneity of time-space with what is true as a being. So Dasein occurs in time and space, and it is, when Dasein is, it is simultaneous with what is true as a being in that time-space. So it is not non-simultaneous, right? So it is not just a remnant of the earlier or a foreshadowing of the next. It is not just a representation of some long gone or some representation of someday to be. It is time spacefully simultaneous with what is true as a being. And it essentially occurs as the grounding ground. So it is a grounding fact as the between and middle of beings themselves. So between beings, in the middle of beings, there is Dasein, there is Bang, mm-hmm. there is the simultaneity of time and space with what is true. There is a grounding.
Yeah, wow.
So it's a place to go, it's a place to be, it's a time-space moment, it's an event. It, and more importantly, it very deliberately divorces itself from the conceptual and representational sequencing of our ideas into chronological patterns of meaning, whereby the form comes to envelop and, in a sense, negate the event.
Totally.
So it just calls into question the whole method of analysis and symptom assessment and historiology and recollection and causation and the giving of reasons and the establishment of ideas as precedent to events and interpretation, study, criticality, very much is called into question with this, that there can be criticality. And of course, the hunt for nature, the hunt for human nature, the hunt for essences, the hunt for forms, the hunt for truisms. Is all a part of that, representing as the first or the a priori. The a priori, you know, the liberals worship at the church of the a priori. Mm-hmm. That is their solace, that is their refuge, that is their cross, that is their scripture, that is what they are evangelizing when they are being liberals. They are saying there are rules, there are laws, there are a priori. There's a whole world of first principles, a priori ideas, and everything in the world needs to abide by that and understand that they are precedent. They take precedence. They are procedurally dominant. And we live as simple manifestations of them. We are remnants of them. We are projections of them. Mm-hmm. And the before is ministerial over the present, and the present is in service to the later. That's progressivism. Mm-hmm. And this sequential formula is the very essence of what it means to be a good person. Mm-hmm. A bad person steps out of this steps off this carousel, which they think is a bullet train, and goes astray.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how would you sort of continue the earlier mention of intrusive thoughts and anxiety with this later section of it not being temporal or timeline, and then the middle and the between?
I mean, I feel like maybe we might want to just try to maybe the recapture a little bit of what we talked about in the car yesterday.
Yeah, sure.
Seems kind of
sure.
What there is there. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, in reading this passage, I'm struck at kind of, you know, when it comes to, let's just take anxiety, right? Like when it comes to asking, oh, you have anxiety. What are we going to do, right? How are we going to fix this, you know? And and I think it's worth at least a little bit of sustained meditation to ask, well, you know, when you're asking what you're supposed to do about the anxiety, what you're really begging for is some more representing as the first. Mm-hmm. you're begging for this analysis, this symptomology, this historiology of your symptoms, of your condition. You're asking about your nature. You're asking to have some kind of sequencing laid out for you, something that you can nestle into and that makes sense of yourself for a little while. And so, in a sense, you're trying. So one might say here that actually you're trying to destroy something by sustaining it, because you know the anxiety is present only because of this representing as the first. It's a symptom of that chain of reasoning that is, again, thousands of years old and is the essence of liberalism. So by partaking in these forms of therapeutic cure, you're kind of not escaping the cage that you're trying to get out of. You're actually just kind of increasing the diameter of the bars. You know, I don't know how much comfort that is, but, you know, I think we're very tormented by the way we think about what a cure is and how it comes about. And so we have to ask ourselves, so all these manners of cure, these templates of cure, these cognitive forms that we align with cure, are they really the gateways to freedom that we think they are? And are they not actually just the metaphysical constructs that have basically given birth to the anxiety that we're trying to escape in the first place?
Yeah.
So that's all pretty abstract, but I think it's in a sense, it's really just about kind of like saying, you know, fuck all of that. I mean, not fuck anxiety, but, you know, this search for the first, the search for the nature, the search for the paradigm and the proper representation, the sequencing that will lead to freedom. It's really systemic, and it's really the machine language of our mind. And so you have to, it's very sneaky, and you have to figure out, well, how is it controlling me, and how is it keeping my thinking in these futile patterns? But you can just kind of say, I want to just get rid of all that. I want to throw that methodology away. I want to throw that habit away. I want to think about things in a different way. You know, it's not going to be easy at first, but through persistence and practice and reformulating the way you think about anxiety, maybe it's possible. I don't know. I mean, I think, yeah. What do you say to that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, how in the world does that look? What does that look like? How do you throw it away? What then are you?
Well, okay, so in the car yesterday, right? In the car. Yeah. So let's try to restage that conversation.
Yeah.
Right? So why don't you start?
Yeah, I said I'm having intrusive thoughts that I would open the door and jump out.
Yeah, we're in the car, right? We're racing down I-10.
Yeah.
And you're having thoughts that you might open the door and jump out of the car. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I say, well, you're not going to do that. That's what I would start by saying, right? Reminds me of that meme. You know, have you seen the meme where I cured my wife's anxiety today by just telling her not to worry about it? You know? I don't know, whatever. I would start by saying, oh, no, you're not going to do that, right? That's not you. You know, it seems that opening the door and jumping out of the car, right? That's like you're gonna kill yourself, right? You're gonna do something that ends your life. And you're sitting in the car with your with your beloved husband and your children, and we're coming from the house we're building to the house we're living in. It's like a beautiful outdoors, you know, it's a beautiful nature around us. It's lovely, and it's a sunset, and you know, it's a lovely time. And why would you throw all that away, right? And why would you just go do that? And so we talked about, you know, this thought is indicative. You have all these other thoughts, and it's always like I'm gonna end my life, right? I'm gonna hurt myself. I'm gonna end my life.
Or it's what if, really?
What if, right? Yeah. So, I don't know, somehow we got to this idea of living, dying,
mm-hmm.
right? And I mean, I think it started by saying, you know, it seems that these an intrusive thought could be thought of as a prompt. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying, where is it coming from? What's the story behind these things? In a way, it's like, well, you know, each intrusive thought is a prompt to reacquaint with your kind of perception on what's going on in life, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we talked about how we had gone on a bike ride,
mm-hmm.
and we'd come to this. I had one kid in front of my bike and one kid on the back of my bike, so two kids on my bike and me. And then we were going down this road, and all of a sudden the road ended, fell off a cliff, and there was a raging river right under it. Right,
mm-hmm.
and I got really close to the edge. And that night, I couldn't sleep because I kept jolting up and realizing that I'd gotten really too close to the edge because I didn't know what was under the road, and the road might have collapsed, and we all would have fallen into the river, and we all would have died, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, so what am I doing when I'm thinking about that? And I, you know, I'm talking to myself, and I'm... One part of me is saying to my other part, you know, you need to be more cautious as you go through life with these kids, right? Mm-hmm. You made a mistake there. You need to be more cautious. So I'm tutoring myself. I'm adjusting myself. And I kind of said that it feels like an actor trying to learn their lines and make their lines more ingrained, more natural to them, so that when they say the line, it just really comes out of them. So I'm training myself as an actor I'm training something in myself, like the actor in myself. I'm directing the actor in myself to be more careful all the time so that I don't get caught off guard and I don't go do something risky and reckless. And so... I and everybody has this kind of adjustment relationship with themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Training the actor that you are. And so I said that, you know, maybe as you're sitting there thinking, I could throw open the door, right? This is a prompt to ask yourself, why am I saying that to myself? Who's saying that to me? How can I have an adjustment relationship with that person? How can I talk to that person? How can I, in this moment, start to retrain myself to listen to my actor, give my actor lines, talk about what's going on, and adjust myself? And I said, I think that there's a little bit with this intrusive thinking, there's a little bit of bone on bone in the self relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I'm sitting there saying to myself, you've got to be more careful when you're got the kids on the bike, and you can't just race up to the edge of a cliff because you don't know if that cliff might fall, you know, I'm discoursing with myself. And what I said was, it feels spongy. Mm-hmm. I've got a sponge over here and I got a sponge over here. One sponge is like the risk-taking sponge, and the other sponge is the caution sponge. And I've got the juice of life in both sponges, but it's feeling a little imbalanced. I've got a little bit too much juice in the risk-taking sponge, so I'm going to squeeze some of it into the cautionary sponge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very... It's very give and take. It's very porous. It's very dialogical. It's very spongy. But I think with intrusive thoughts, it's a little bone on bone, because it's like the intrusive thought occurs and you say no, and it says yes, and you say no, and it just becomes a hard fight, right? Mm-hmm. But really, the intrusive thought is you talking to yourself, mm-hmm. and so you need to start sitting down and squeezing those sponges and trying to talk to whoever is saying these things and really, have a dialogue with them and make some adjustments. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's one aspect. But then we talked about, opening the door of the car, you would die, right? You would die. So you're afraid of dying, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how did we get to the whole living dying thing? Do you remember?
I think you said that it's basically a prompt to think about death more. Death and life to sort of be there in a relationship and to not just ignore or cast aside.
Yeah, so I'm thinking that this. I mean, yeah, we really got on this idea of it being a prompt. Yeah. It being a prompt feels to me like an answer to your question of like, so what would that look like to not be going back looking for a nature, a paradigm, and a priori a first?
Yeah.
An alternative to that is that this thought, I could, and it's always a could, I might, I could open it's the door if. And jump out of the car.
It's what if.
What if?
Yeah.
What if I did? Okay.
Yeah.
But again, so what if I did? So, I don't know, what if you did? You would open the door and you'd fly out and we're going 80 miles an hour and you'd die.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not much interesting what if there, right? Mm-hmm. But it seems a prompt to say, oh, you want to think about death, do you? Mm-hmm. Is that what you want to think about? Clearly, you want to think about death. And by you, I mean that's why I take issue with the idea of intrusive thought. No, you are talking to you. Mm-hmm. And some you wants to talk about death. Mm-hmm. Now, another you does not want to talk about death. Right?
Yeah.
But it would seem by the insistency and consistency and persistency of your intrusive thoughts that a big part of you wants to talk about death. And the way it's doing that is it's saying, what if you did this? Well, you'd die. Mm-hmm. What if you did this? Well, you'd die. So it's like a five-year-old saying, Mommy, what if I did this? What if I did this? They want to talk about death. Mm-hmm. They want to know what the hell that is. They want to hear about it. But of course, the person listening is scared and doesn't like talking about death and doesn't want to talk about death. Mm-hmm. Right? So we got onto the living dying. We got onto realizing that living is dying. Mm-hmm. And that dying is living, and instead of saying we're living, we could actually just say we're dying, and that there is a lot of energy, nothing deep here, put into denying death and not thinking about death and avoiding death and avoiding thoughts of death, and that is a deception, that's a lie. That we link that with the idea of liberal progressivism, mm-hmm. that everything's got to be getting better, that everything is getting, everything's improving, that utopia is becoming closer, mm-hmm. that death is getting easier. But the truth is that everything is living, everything that's living is dying. Mm-hmm. And we want to understand the living dying. And the intrusive thoughts are something is you begging you mm-hmm. to look at the living dying, mm-hmm. to look at the dying and think about the dying. And we talked about how that's not morbid. Mm-hmm. This is not like, oh, let's just think about death. No, it's a looking at, it's a perspective, it's a experience, it's a sensation in the body, it's an impression, it's an apperception, that it, with everything that is that you see. And we talked about looking at the landscape and looking at the plants and looking at the mountains and looking at the air, and you know that everything is living, and that means it's dying. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's our son. That's not morbid. That's just true. And we talked about how, you know, what we really want is we want truth. We want to know what's true, and true is the living dying. And you know, so these thoughts are a prompt to you to think about the true. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to. You're scared. You don't like it. You don't want to think about death, right? Mm-hmm. But the more you deny that, the more your thoughts, you know, you are not going to let you go. Mm-hmm. You are not going to let you lie to yourself. Mm-hmm. You know the truth. And the you that's denying the truth is not going to sleep a single night until that you addresses the you that really wants to know the truth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So instead of asking what's the cause of intrusive thoughts, what's the essence of intrusive thoughts, what's the form, what's the firstness, what's the a priori rules of intrusive thoughts that I can get into so then I can just get rid of intrusive thoughts. Intrusive thoughts occur, and in a sense, you know, they are the simultaneity of time-space with what is true as a being. Mm-hmm. Do you get that? They are the simultaneity of time-space with what is true as a being. So you are a being, and what is true of you, right, mm-hmm. is you are living, dying. Mm-hmm. And that comes to you simultaneously with certain time space events, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It comes to you in a time, it comes to you in a space, and it is a true, and it is between all beings. It's bang. Mm-hmm. And it's a prompt to be there with your urge to understand death. Mm-hmm. And so you need to do that in the moment, at that very moment. Again and again. So yeah, I don't know. I've talked a lot. What's your memory of the whole thing? What do you take from this?
Yeah. I thought it was very insightful and felt very truthful that was like a. The part, like part of the conversation, or what's being talked about, and that I've had a long history of ignoring it or not wanting to think about it, and fearing that thinking about it would be dangerous.
Yeah, I remember you saying that you were afraid that if you think about death, or you, I don't know, what do you say, become okay with death?
Yeah, right.
That you're gonna want it.
Yeah.
Well, we kind of talked about, I guess, you know, that I'm not sure that, I don't know if it's, first of all, I'm not sure it's about becoming okay with death. I mean, recognizing that living is dying it's not really about being okay with reality or the truth. Like the truth is, I mean, it's a little more about asking yourself, why do I even have any issue with the truth, right? And also, it's not really about desire. There's no want in the equation, because mm-hmm. again, like when you say, "What if I jump out of the car?" You're not really having this experience of like, "I want to jump out of the car," mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But So desire seems out of the equation, maybe, I guess, mm-hmm. is the way to put it. But why did all that ring true to you? And do you think that we're talking about something other than the form of intrusive thoughts?
That's a good question. Yeah.
I mean, haven't you talked to your therapist or somebody about these intrusive thoughts having to do with death and your attitude toward death? Is that a new topic?
That's actually never come up.
Okay.
Which, you know, I mean, I think like you've said, anxiety is just a fear of death. So it's sort of absurd that it's never come up, but, at least that I can remember. I mean, I think there's something very interesting to not looking at it sequentially, to sort of trying to look at it with a different, I guess, timeline or sequence, or like go in it at a different spot.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that feels disruptive. Sorry, mm-hmm. that, not to use that word, but like it just feels like it's something else. It feels different. Mm-hmm. It feels different. And I do think it is definitely a topic that I just like don't really like and haven't thought much about. So I think it's very true that it's something that like I've pushed away. And when I look out at the land, and if instead of seeing, I guess, death as like the scary thing I'm pushing away, it feels more, I mean, there's like death out in the land. I feel like you see it.
Yeah.
Especially in the desert, right? You like really see it.
Yeah.
So kind of actually somehow like facing that or letting it be what it is a different way. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's just a different form, but if it definitely has like has it has ringings or bits of like feeling like it's like a fresh way or like a different way. 'Cause I feel like so much of it for me, so much of anxiety is just getting stuck in habits and patterns and just cognitive sequences that are really hard to detangle and to take power away from.
Yeah.
And something about it feels like it's sort of like poking holes in it or like kind of just really coming at it from a different direction, I guess.
Yeah. Well, good.
Yeah, I thought it was a very.
I mean, it does seem very tangibly, if you can say thoughts are tangible, different to instead of diagnosing intrusive thoughts in the old way of looking for first causes and forms and a priori rules that will help dismantle these things in general,
mm-hmm.
that each intrusive thought is a specific prompt to engage in a conversation with the self that is presenting the thought mm-hmm. about the topic at hand. Mm-hmm. That's it, just the topic at hand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that case, in that instance, it's very clear that, you know, I mean, I think you're a little shaky about cars. Cars can be mm-hmm. scary. Driving down the highway can be scary. Sitting in a door with a door there that could open is scary. People do die in cars. So that's all very real. And you know, the jumping out of the car is a what if that a part of you is like, can we talk about this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, it might be that this you that's asking that question, what if I jump out of the car, just needs to be reassured that that would be really bad. Right? I mean, Think about it as like a four-year-old. Mommy, what if I held my hand over the fire?
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you what that would be like. You would burn yourself, and you would have scars, and you would hurt incredibly bad, and you would be maimed for life, and blah, blah, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Okay. Like somebody wants to have a conversation there and then.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, they don't really care about your theories about intrusive thoughts.
Yeah.
What they want is a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So you should be the brave parent and have a conversation about that thing, even though that thing scares you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these conversations might be things you need to have with yourself with great and perhaps annoying frequency at first.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe they'll start to become less common.
Mm-hmm.
But in the process, there's going to be a reacquainting with the living dying, as we call it,
mm-hmm.
where you're really having to think about the realities of death,
mm-hmm.
and what you want and what you do not want. And one thing that I think, you know, is great about the living dying, seeing the world as not as a living thing, but as a living dying thing, seeing everything as a living dying thing and living being the same as dying, is that you just get to know things better and you get to appreciate things. If you think about your 2-year-old as a living dying thing, then your relationship with them all of a sudden is just a lot more wonderful, in my view. It's not sad. It's actually like, this is all we have. Like, this is it. It's right now. We are living, dying. And let's seize the moment, you know?
Yeah, it reminds me of this TikTok or Instagram, whatever, thing that, like, literally every time I see it, it makes me cry. It's just the one that's like, it basically says that, like, the saddest part about being a parent is you, you never get to say goodbye to the stages that your kid is in or is growing out of. So like, it's like, oh, you love the like crawler, but then you never get to say goodbye to it.
Mm.
So that makes me think of living, dying.
Mm. Why don't you get to say goodbye to it? Because they've just moved on to another thing.
Yeah, so sort of part of it's dying while living.
Yeah,
but well, I don't know if that actually is a good...
Well, so maybe it's time to say goodbye. Maybe you can say goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it is like, oh, maybe having a kid is a long series of goodbyes.
Yeah.
And that can be beautiful. Because that's the other thing we talked about is, sort of, you know, again, that's sort of, I think, embedded in liberalism is this deep self-deceiving preference for just the living.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to talk about the dying. So...
Yeah, it's funny. Our daughter, like, loves to say bye. Like,
yeah.
Like, she met someone new, and they were just like, I think she just wants to say bye, and she just wants me to leave. But it's kind of funny, but she always likes to say bye because it's, like, a marking that she's going somewhere.
Yeah.
And then typically she's about to turn around and say hi again.
Yeah. No, so it's just her life is like a big already, cycle of highs and byes.
It
right
is,
now.
Yeah.
High and bye, high and bye, high and bye. Yeah.
I don't know. Is that really living, dying?
I mean, yeah, I mean, that's like the Fort Da of Freud, right? Like, what's that thing where the little Hans is like throwing the ball over the crib or something and watching it disappear and, you know, becoming aware of the idea that things come and go, right? Mm. Things disappear. Mommy comes, then mommy goes. I mean, kids realize that really early on. Mm-hmm. I want to try. I mean, I think you know, I said, you know, liberalism and doesn't want to talk about dying. I mean, I think that could be seen as a rather shallow remark. And I mean, maybe it is, but I think in what sense I mean it. I mean, I think bottom line is that, like, what I'm calling the living dying is the truth of bang. And it's not before something or after something. It's not a priori. It's not a law. It's not human custom. It's not, it's in a way, so the self-emergent, right? The physis, right? Mm-hmm. The physis is nature. It's the self-emergent. You know, there's bias in that word just to begin with, because the self-emergent is the self-destroying, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, creation is destruction, all that kind of stuff. I think that there is like a kind of like a forced positivity, a forced blindness, a forced preference for the progressive and the positive in liberalism that a lot of people find really appealing. But then you have this counter proposal by the post-liberal thinkers now that, you know, liberalism lacks what they call common sense or or an attunement to realities or outcomes. I mean, there's lots of different ways of saying it, the effects of things, right? And I think that's the living dying that I'm talking about, is that things are always a lot more immediate and therefore complicated than liberal prescriptions and progressive canards would care to think about. Mm-hmm. You hear post-liberal thinkers say all the time that liberalism is an ideology, so it's really actually averse to the question of outcomes, because really its goal is the perpetuation of its ideology. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the perpetuation of your ideology is an imbalance of living over dying. Because you're trying to get the ideology to live forever, and for all of us to live in accordance with that living forever ideology. And so, sure, liberals sit around talking about death just as much as anybody else, you know. And I'm not saying liberals don't talk or think or experience death. I'm just saying that in liberalism, I think that it kind of inherited this from Christianity, that it is in its teleology and its prospects for the future, it's engaging in a imbalance between the perception of living and the misperception of dying, or the denial of dying. Hmm. I guess. So there's something, and, you know, it's something grounding, and Heidegger uses that word grounding in the last paragraph. You know, there's something grounding about the living dying, because, you know, it is clearly the truth that living is dying, and in everything, there's not just the self emerging, there's the self disappearing, the self going away. You know, and physis, they want, you know, it wants to define nature as the self-emerging, but that's only one side of nature. Nature is also the self-disappearing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So I think growing up as a liberal, we are taken away from death. We're told not to see the living dying. We're told to only see the living. And but the dying will in, and we know we are dying, and that knowledge manifests itself in all kinds of ways. And what if thoughts about death is one of those ways. Mm-hmm. And it's calling us to see that living is dying, mm-hmm. and to engage with it, not as depression, but as, in a way, a joyful relationship with the truth. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I guess we're done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something you want to say?
I guess so. No, I can't think of anything.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.